Last time, we considered virtue ethics, which suggests that we should concentrate less on trying to figure out which actions are moral or immoral, and focus instead on figuring out how to be a virtuous person. This is how virtue ethicists think that we can be happiest, how we can attain eudaimonia, flourishing or well-being, and realize our true potential, how we can live the best possible life that we can live. But, at least according to some virtue ethicists, like Aristotle, being virtuous is only necessary for attaining eudaimonia. It is not sufficient. There's a little bit of luck involved, you might say. You can't be virtuous unless you can find virtuous people to help instill the virtues in you, and sometimes that's just a matter of luck. And something like a crippling accident could also prevent you from living the best kind of life. Or maybe a loved one suffers an untimely death. That could make eudaimonia impossible to accomplish as well. Or maybe you're just so ugly that you have no loved ones in the first place. Nah, I'm sure you're fine. But this leads to an interesting question. What if you had to choose between being a virtuous person who suffered many hardships and being a wicked person who had it easy? Consider the difference between someone who devotes himself to virtue and lives a life of poverty and hardship as a result, and someone who devotes himself to materialistic gain and lives a life of luxury. Take it a step further. Who's better off? Someone who actually lives a life of virtue and faces hardship as a result, including the hardship of being scorned by the public and even being considered an unvirtuous person by the public? Or someone who actually is unvirtuous, but lives a life of luxury and adoration as a result, and is even considered to be a virtuous person by the public? Now, it's difficult to think of a popular modern example of someone in the real world who fits the first description of being truly virtuous, but being scorned by the public. After all, if they're scorned, they likely don't receive much attention. Perhaps doctors and nurses who worked with Ebola patients in Africa, but who were feared to have brought back Ebola to the U.S., that might qualify. They showed great courage to do such work, but then were kind of shunned and vilified by the public back home when they returned. Unvirtuous people, revered as virtuous people by the public, on the other hand, are a little bit easier to identify. Think of Jim Baker, the televangelist who was revered as a virtuous Christian, but who turned out to be a thief and an adulterer. He robbed his followers of millions and had an affair with Jessica Hahn. Plato, however, provides us with the best example of a virtuous person who lived a hard life and who was scorned by the public as an unvirtuous person. Socrates. Using his devotion to the intellectual virtues, Socrates strove daily to understand all the virtues so that he could be virtuous. He taught others, but never charged a fee. In fact, his quest for virtuousness left him fairly impoverished. Yet Socrates was largely hated by the public. In his quest for knowledge, he sought out others, but in doing so, he exposed their ignorance. He exposed the fact that although they said they knew what the virtues were, they didn't truly know. Philosophy can do that. Philosophy can be very abrasive, and philosophers are sometimes not liked because of that. Just with Socrates, eventually he was brought to trial in Athens and was put to death. He truly was virtuous, but he lived a hard life as a result and was considered unvirtuous and reviled by the public. Compare Socrates to Gyges of Lydia, who, according to myth, found a ring that made him invisible, kind of like the one ring that made Bilbo and Frodo invisible when they wore it in Lord of the Rings. In fact, I often wonder if the Gyges myth isn't where Tolkien got that idea. But according to the Gyges myth, instead of destroying the ring in the fires of Mount Doom, Gyges used his ring of invisibility to nefariously and secretly seduce the king of Lydia's wife, and then become king himself. Yet, since he was able to do all of these dastardly deeds while invisible, He made it look like all of this good fortune just fell into his lap, and everyone revered him as a great and virtuous man. As Glaucon, the brother of Plato, recounts in The Republic, the worry is this. Most people believe that acting unjustly, being able to take what you want without paying, killing your enemies, freeing your friends from jail, and usurping the throne and stealing the king's wife, really, that would guarantee happiness in life if it weren't for the public scorn and ridicule that accompanied getting caught doing such actions. But if you could do all that without being caught, say, because you could be invisible, then you could and would do them and be much happier as a result, live a better kind of life even. In reality, he says, virtue only seems to lead to a better life because it gets you the benefits of being recognized as a virtuous person. So Glaucon suggests, wouldn't many suggest that it's actually better to not be virtuous, but just to be regarded by the public as virtuous? You actually lead a better, happier, and more flourishing life if you aren't virtuous, but are regarded as virtuous. In other words, being virtuous really doesn't lead to eudaimonia, only being regarded as virtuous does. If this is right, and the wicked person who lives a life of luxury lives a better life, we're forced to ask the question of this lecture. Why bother being good? Why bother being moral in the first place or being virtuous? Why not just be concerned with living the easy life and not worry about being virtuous and living a morally good life? To understand this question, we're going to look to Plato's Republic, because the overarching argument of the entire work is that the common idea that Glaucon identifies is wrong. Being virtuous, or just as Plato would put it, really is the only way to be the happiest that you can be, the way to lead the most flourishing and worthwhile life. It's the only way to achieve eudaimonia. And even if you're not regarded by the public as virtuous and instead are scorned, you're still better off being virtuous, even better off than the wicked person who is perceived as virtuous and leads a life of luxury like Gyges. But to get us to that conclusion, Plato takes us on a roundabout journey, a great big argument from analogy. He's going to describe what the virtuous or just society looks like and compare that to what the most just or virtuous individual is like. And he'll argue, in the same way that the virtue of the best kind of society leads to the most flourishing, so too will the virtue of the individual lead to flourishing. And so the Republic will serve as the perfect transition between our previous section on ethics and the upcoming section on political philosophy. In our final defense of the notion that a virtuous life is the best and only way to achieve eudaimonia, we'll also see one of the most famous arguments for how society ought to be organized. So, let's dive right in. Now, remember, even though Plato wrote The Republic, Plato's work, it's a dialogue that features the character of Socrates as its protagonist. So all the arguments that come out of Socrates' mouth, but in a certain kind of way, they're also Plato's arguments. In The Republic, according to Socrates, the most just society, what he called The Republic, would be divided into three classes, each dedicated to a specific function. The workers, the guardians, or what he later calls the auxiliary, and the rulers. Now, keep in mind that Plato was conceiving of a city-state, so his suggestion is far more applicable to kind of a smaller population. But it might still be possible to expand his ideas to nation-states as large as we know today. For example, the workers would be dedicated in Plato's Republic to supplying the material needs of the Republic, the food and water, the housing, the clothes. Today, this would include farmers, healthcare workers, sanitation workers, and educators. In the Republic, the auxiliary, in Plato's society, the auxiliary is dedicated to protecting the public and keeping it in order. This would be kind of a combination military police force. Its members, or soldiers, let's call them, would be military in that they would protect the city from foreign invasion. They would also be police in that they would keep the city in order. If any of the workers got out of line by disobeying the laws of the city, by stealing, for example, it would be the soldiers of the auxiliary who would set them straight. Ideally, these soldiers would be perfectly dedicated to the state, willing to die in its service. And as such, they would own no property, Socrates says. Everything they need would be provided by the state. What's more, Socrates says, they would be engaged in a selective breeding program where the strongest and smartest soldiers were paired together as mates to ensure an ever-improving class of soldiers in the future. The members of the auxiliary themselves would be courageous, loyal, educated, and, of course, in superior physical condition, and certainly would think it better to die in service than to live outside of it. The rulers, whose obvious role would be that of the leadership of the Republic to rule it, must be courageous and loyal as well, but most importantly, they should be wise. They should have a good understanding of how societies function, what laws are best, how they are best enforced, and so on. According to Plato, this is only possible if one has an intimate knowledge of the forms. Remember the forms, the abstract objects that are the perfect examples of justice and fairness, etc. So the rulers would be philosophers. This is where we get the term the philosopher king. Now, you might think that this is just self-serving. Of course Socrates wants philosophers to be the rulers. He's a philosopher. But Socrates points out that neither he nor any philosopher would actually want to rule. A true philosopher seeks wisdom above all else, and the drudgery and responsibility of ruling would simply be a distraction from that quest. I know I feel this way about eventually becoming chair of my department. All of those administrative duties are going to get in the way of my research and teaching. Likewise, the philosopher would rather be doing philosophy than ruling. But the philosophers will fulfill their duty to rule anyway, not only out of a sense of duty, but also because they would dread being ruled over by someone who is not a proper ruler, someone who doesn't understand justice and virtue in the forms. Right? To ensure that every person plays the role best suited to their abilities, that everyone finds themselves in the class in which they belong, the state will evaluate all persons and place them accordingly. In fact, all children will be raised by the state in the Republic. Their talents and abilities will be decided at an early age, and they'll be trained for and then placed into the appropriate class when they're adults. In fact, Socrates suggests that the only way to really accomplish such a state, to really accomplish the Republic, would be to start from scratch with a population of children that you subsequently trained and then placed in their proper places. Sanctioning off adults into classes, it simply just would not be feasible. Now, Socrates admits that such a city would be unstable. It would be sick, if you will, because of what he called pleonexia, the human tendency to overreach. Those placed in a certain class may think they deserve more. Certain workers might want to be a soldier or be a ruler, positions for which they are unqualified. To avoid this problem, Socrates suggests telling the populace a noble lie. What is that lie? That the gods had determined everyone's class by placing metal into everyone. The workers have iron and bronze, and soldiers have silver in them, and the rulers have gold. Of course, Socrates knows this is bunk. I personally doubt whether Plato or Socrates actually believed in the gods anyway. But this lie, adequately reinforced, would stabilize the Republic and keep everyone in their place. Socrates argues that this society is just and indeed virtuous because of its organization and the properties it has. The Republic embodies the intellectual virtues, because the rulers are wise. The Republic is courageous because the soldiers of the auxiliary are courageous. And the Republic is temperate because it is self-controlled. Everyone does their own job, and the auxiliary keeps the workers in line. But all of this is also Socrates' way of explaining what a just and virtuous person is like. A virtuous person is like the Republic. They're organized in the same kind of way. According to Socrates, a person's mind or soul, and we need not think of souls in this case as a separable entity, although Plato did think of them this way. But for Socrates, a person's mind or soul is divided into three parts. We have what he called a tripartite soul, which consists of the logos, our reason, the thymos, our spirit or our drive, and the epithymia, our appetites. And a virtuous person has those parts organized like the Republic organizes its classes. So, for the virtuous person, reason rules. It sets the laws and makes the decisions just like the rulers in the Republic. This is what makes a virtuous person wise. The appetites, like the workers, provide for the needs of the body. For example, the appetite of hunger causes one to fulfill his nutritional needs. And our drive keeps those appetites in line. It does not allow them to rule or be in control. It exercises willpower over them. So in this way, the virtuous person is temperate or controlled. Our drive is also responsible for defending the body in a responsible way from those who might harm it. This is what makes the virtuous person courageous. So, a just state is one in which each class is fulfilling its function. The workers provide the necessities, the soldiers control and protect the workers, and the rulers rule with wisdom. Likewise, a just person is one whose parts are fulfilling their proper function, whose appetites provide the necessities of survival, but don't control the person because they are tempered by their drive, and whose drive protects the person, but is ultimately ruled by reason. Plato argues that such a virtuous person flourishes, attains eudaimonia, in the same way and for the same reason that the Republic flourishes. This is why the virtuous person is better off than the wicked person, even if the virtuous person is scorned and the wicked person is not. And to make his case that this is true, Socrates draws an analogy between different kinds of governments or societies and different kinds of persons, and shows that a kind of more virtue, more flourishing pattern emerges in both. We can best understand the analogy with a mental chart that has the virtuous state, the Republic, on the left, and the virtuous person on the right. We'll imagine those on top, the virtuous versions on top, and we'll work our way down. If the Republic were to degenerate into the second best form of government, it would turn into a timocracy, says Socrates, a city ruled by its soldiers. The auxiliary would overthrow the rulers and take charge. The main goal of such a city would be the preservation of its honor, so to speak, its own protection. It might not even be unlike a police state. Analogously, we might think of a person who holds self-protection and honor as their highest value, a person whose drive or their competitive nature completely rules them. That would be somewhat analogous to this kind of timocracy. We might think of a gentleman duelist as an example of such a person, someone who is constantly slapping people in the face with his glove when they insult his honor. Or, better yet, think of the race of Klingons from Star Trek, whose main goal in life is to preserve their honor and die in battle. But, Socrates argues, this new ruling class is apt to become corrupt. Once it's secure from invasion, wealth will become the ruler's new priority. And so the society will degenerate or degrade into an oligarchy, a city where a small rich minority govern over a larger but more, much more poorer class. Compare this to a person whose main goal is the acquisition of wealth. Unlike with Epicureanism, here I think we can think of the Wolf of Wall Street, Jordan Belfort, whose appetite for wealth ruled him. It, not his reason, kept his other appetites in line, but only to make sure that he can acquire more wealth. But as the poor become fed up and realize that they can, they will revolt, says Socrates, and turn the oligarchy into a democracy, a government where the workers rule. Now, it's important to note that Socrates did not have in mind the kind of representative democracy we have today, where we elect representatives to a governing body. And I'm not so sure how he would have regarded it. My guess is probably not too highly. Notice that democracy is pretty far down on the list here. We're getting worse and worse forms of government. Instead, he's talking about a direct democracy, where every person has exactly one vote in every decision the government makes, where there is no president or Congress, and every person has exactly the same power in every decision, and the majority always rules. One shortcoming of a direct democracy, says Socrates, is that in practice, it simply leads to the power resting in whoever can manipulate popular opinion. Not only will this prevent any rational decisions from being made, but because different people can be persuasive on different days, nothing useful will ever get done. Compare this kind of government, this kind of society, to someone who is ruled by his appetites, right? Worker-ruled city, appetite-ruled person. A person who seeks to satisfy whatever appetite is currently the strongest, and then once it is fulfilled, turns to the next appetite. Here, we might think of the college frat boy spring breaker who will let his appetite for alcohol rule him until his appetite for sex takes over, and then his appetite for food, and so on. But the real danger of democracy is freedom, says Socrates. Too much of the wrong kind of freedom. In a democracy, Socrates argues, the people will keep demanding more and more freedom from laws until they are left with anarchy. And from this anarchy, a tyrant will eventually emerge. And thus, democracy will degenerate into tyranny. And this tyrant will have to fight for control, kind of like in Game of Thrones, as other would-be rulers vie for power. And so, Plato argues, this quest in democracy for more and more freedom will likely just lead to slavery. For Socrates, real freedom on a personal level is not found in doing whatever you want to do whenever you want to do it. It's found in establishing a law within oneself and not saying yes to every appetite that springs to mind. Otherwise, certain appetites will start to vie for total control, and eventually you will be ruled by a single one. Like drug addicts are ruled by their appetite for their drug. Again, the quest for total freedom leads to slavery. As we look at these governments and societies, we see a more justice, more flourishing pattern emerge. Clearly, as you go down the list, moving from the republic to the tyranny, each society is a little bit less just than the last, and each society flourishes a little bit less than the last. There are certainly fewer opportunities for intellectual pursuits and advancements, or even for citizens to leave good lives, the further you go down the list. Conversely, as we go up the list, we see that the more just a society is, the more flourishing and the more opportunity it gives a citizen to flourish. We can see a similar pattern emerge in individuals. Clearly, the appetite-ruled drug addict does not lead a flourishing life. He is a slave to his addiction. And although it's better to be the frat boy on spring break, such an existence is still shallow and vain and not conducive to human flourishing. Allowing one's desire for wealth to temper one's own appetites is a little bit better, as is being concerned with one's honor. But clearly, the pattern holds, the kind of life most conducive to flourishing, to eudaimonia, is that of the virtuous person. The person who is wise because her reason rules her actions, courageous because her drive is properly motivated, and tempered because she controls her appetites, is the person who is most likely to live the kind of life most worth living. And so, Plato argues, it's reasonable to conclude that such a virtuous person still flourishes and is even happier than may otherwise be expected, even if they do suffer hardships, even if they're regarded by the public as unvirtuous. Being virtuous comes with its own kind of internal reward that makes it worth attaining regardless of whether it is recognized. For Plato, both the just person and the just society partake in the same thing, the form of justice. And because they do so, a similar consequence follows for both. And so now we understand the Platonic defense of the virtue ethicist's claim that the reward of being virtuous is eudaimonia. We now have Plato's answer to the question, why be moral? It's the only way to lead the best kind of life. And we've just seen that, just like for Aristotle, for Plato, reason plays a prominent role in the attainment of eudaimonia. But we've also seen what Plato thought about how society ought to be organized. And, in all honesty, most of us would likely not be too keen on living in Plato's Republic. We wouldn't like being lied to, told what class to live in, or what job to have, or having our children raised by the state. Plato's Republic lacks the kind of freedom that you likely think is necessary for the existence of a just government. And so Plato's Republic leads to yet another set of questions. If society should not be organized, as Plato suggested, then how exactly should it be organized? Is freedom that important? If so, why? And how far should our freedoms go? How big should government be? And what are its responsibilities? Should it ensure fairness? And what justifies government in the first place? It is to those questions that we shall turn in the next and final section of this course. But before we do, let me wrap up this section with some concluding remarks. Philosophy can be frustrating because it's so difficult to find concrete answers. For example, we just studied a number of ethical theories, but each one failed in one way or the other. We didn't definitively define what's morally right and wrong, and we certainly didn't find the truth makers for moral statements we were looking for. Now, this might tempt us to draw the conclusion that, just like with free will and persons in the mind, that morality is just an illusion. The reason that we can't find a ground for moral facts is because there are none. And that might be true. However, I believe we can still take what we've learned and use it to guide our actions. How? We can use a method of moral reasoning suggested by Theodor Schick in the introduction to his textbook, Doing Philosophy, that he calls Inference to the Best Action. Recall that when doing abduction, inference to the best explanation, we consider multiple criteria, testability, scope, etc., and choose the hypothesis that coheres with the most of them. Schick suggests we do something similar when reasoning about ethics by taking each of the major ethical theories and treating each one of them as a criterion. The more an action aligns with them, the better it is. And when doing an action clearly fulfills more of the criteria than not doing the action, then that is the moral thing to do. If we took the five theories we've considered that seem to have the most traction, our criteria might look like this. Hedonistic happiness, the extent to which an action makes one's life better. Does it produce worthwhile pleasures? Kantian justice, the extent to which an action respects individual rights and treats people equally. Is it something that I could will to be universalized? Does it treat others as a means to an end? Utilitarian beneficence, the extent to which an action alleviates the most unnecessary suffering and pain and promotes the best kind of happiness. Does the action promote the good of the many over the good of the few or the one? Virtuousness, the extent to which an action reflects what a moral exemplar would do or value. Is the action consistent with a life that is conducive to well-being or eudaimonia? And feminist carefulness, the extent to which the action reflects care for others. Does the action allow me to display a justified preference for those I care about? When we are presented with ethical conundrums, we can discover what we should do by considering our options and simply figuring out which one fulfills the most of these criteria. Of course, sometimes there will be ties, so inference to the best action won't always answer all our questions, but the same is true for scientific abduction, and yet it's still the best method we have. The same would seem to be true for this kind of ethical abduction. At the very least, we could arrive at rational ethical answers more often than we did before. As you may have noticed, however, the Kantian justice criterion mentioned rights, and we haven't talked much about rights yet. That's because rights are usually the kind of thing a government is tasked to protect. And yet to do so, it seems it must inevitably infringe on them. This opens a whole host of questions about government, the most fundamental of which we shall consider next. Should government exist at all? Does it have the moral authority to do what it does?